Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to another Tuesday night podcast with the Nashka family. This is Bailey Smith, hosting from Deerfield Beach, Florida. First, I would like to give out our phone number before I introduce our panelists and our co-hosts. It's 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. Tuesday nights, we have open mic night for questions and answers. I'm here with Bill Murray and our co-host, Lori Golden, from San Diego, California. By the way, Bill Murray is my neighbor. He's from Pompano Beach, Florida. Lori is a survivor of incest, her father. Lori used drugs in college and covered her worthlessness, aloneness, and increasing desperation with bulimic exercise, food addiction, and drugs. She has also attempted suicide. There's a lot more about Lori. I can relate to some of her stuff. And I would like to bring her on. Again, we'd love to hear from our guests. 646-595-2118. I am going to bring on my trailer co-host, Bill Murray. Hey, Bill.
Bailey, thanks very much for hosting tonight. I'm looking forward to the show, and I hope a few more call in, but we'll be fine. Thanks for being here.
Yep. Thank you. And here we go. Here's Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Hi, Bill. Hi,
Bill. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you? I'm okay. How are you?
Well, today was an okay day. So, I'm good. Thank you for asking.
You're good?
Yeah.
Okay. I know. What I've learned, yes, what I've learned, I think one of the best gifts I ever got from being in recovery from drugs and everything that I've been in recovery from, including incest recovery, is that we get to live a day at a time. And mm-hmm. on any given day, you can feel something, and on another day, it goes away. And I used to think that if I felt bad on the morning, so to speak, that the rest of my day, the rest of my life would look awful. So right. It's really nice to live a day at a time.
One day at a time,
so,
one step at a time.
Yep. In for this recovery, it really is one step at a time.
It definitely is. Well, we're so happy to have you here. How's everything going for you? I know that Bill doesn't like to get off topic, but I have to ask, how are you doing during this crazy time with COVID and, you know, the violence that we had recently? How are you doing in San Diego?
Well, there's a lot going on. And more than anything, what I like to do is find a way that I can be peaceful in myself with all the craziness that might be going on outside of myself, and finding my ability to do that has really been a wonderful, I'm completely grateful for my ability to be able to do that. And what I found is peace for me is not fighting with myself. That peace, you can fight, there's a lot of fighting going on. A lot of very important issues are going on, don't get me wrong. COVID has really impacted people that I work with. More than anything, there's a loss of the ease of going about your day. I find that that loss has created a certain kind of sadness in people. And it really does feel like, you know, just getting in your car and going to the store feels like a lot right now. And it's, when I see people with face masks, I'm still struggling with the reality of where we are at this point in time. And the uncertainty, I'm not struggling with the uncertainty because I know uncertainty is part of living, but the fact is it's really uncertain what's next. And no one seems to have any clear answers. So it's a lot of uncertainty. Are you feeling the uncertainty?
Yes. You know, first of all, I think it's amazing that you've created coping skills to be able to get through this, because so many people are having PTSD and triggers of being of when they were at home and not being able to go out much. So it's amazing because you're probably one of the first on a Tuesday night that I host that has had a positive attitude. And obviously you're at peace and you're using your coping skills or whatever it is to get through the day. I relate so much to what you just said about the uncertainty of each day, how our day is so turned around. Somebody will say to me, when's a good day to have an appointment? When's a good day to get together? I'm like, I'm an open book. I have an open schedule. I don't have any plans. And usually I have I'm always busy. I always have something going on. So it's like you get up. Okay, I started going back to the gym, so at least I start my day that way. But then it's what next? What am I doing the rest of the, So, and then again, every time I get into the car to a store, I get anxiety to have to put that mask on. And then I look around and I look at everybody and I'm like, is this our new normal? Is this the way it's going to be? When is it going to end? The uncertainty, again, like you said, in life is filled with uncertainties, but there's an anguish, and I can't explain the feeling that I get personally. I don't know. It's this is not fun. This is so not fun.
No, it's not. So. And I, coping with uncertainty as a survivor of incest has been, I have really worked hard on learning how to be in uncertainty and not turn uncertainty into a horror show. Because for me, uncertainty meant I was living in fear. So uncertainty today doesn't have to be living in fear. It can be living in the day, because the truth is, outside of today, we really don't know what's going to happen on any given day. I've had lots of sudden things happen in my life that were unexpected on any given day. And I've learned that, you know, the fear that I grew up in does not have to be the way I live in myself today and live in the world today. And there was a time that if I was in my abuse, certainly when I was in my abuse memories and having flashbacks, this kind of isolation brought about by COVID would be very intense for me. I would have felt frightened. I would have felt cut off. I would have felt alone. It would have felt unsafe. So I think it brings up a lot in people right now, and particularly for those people who are in the middle of their recovery from abuse.
Yes. Well, you know, I give you a lot of credit. And like you said, life is filled with uncertainties. And now this, you know, this is a new uncertainty on top of everything else. And yes, it does trigger a lot of people. I know for myself, the isolation was very, very difficult. For me, too much time to think is not a great thing. I know Bill also had amazing coping skills and dealt with this, and I'm sure he'll talk about it. He had such a positive view on how to cope and deal with what we're all going through. But unfortunately, there are many of us that don't. We do have our coping skills, but we're so overwhelmed or sad or depressed that sometimes it's hard to go to fetch them or bring them off the shelf. So I would love to give Bill a chance to pipe in.
Hi, Bill.
Sure. Hi, Lori. But Bailey knows me pretty well. We've shared through the pandemic a number of times, and she knows that I'm not having much reaction to or problem with the shutdown of society and so forth, and having to wear the mask is a little inconvenient, but it's not a big deal to me. But I think it's interesting what Lori started the program with tonight was the notion that that feelings are temporary, which was a new idea for me early in recovery. I thought I was destined to have the same group of horrible feelings, terrible feelings, forever and ever, and there was nothing I could do about it. That's just the way life was. And then I started to have experiences which brought me relief. One day I got so much relief I didn't know what it was, and my sponsor had to tell me that's serenity, which we pray for, because it was like being devoid of feelings. I didn't know what it was. And then life comes back and so forth. So it's cyclical for a long time. I mean, it always is. It still is today, to be honest. I don't know what might occur, you know, tomorrow that would change how I am. But basically, through the last many months, certainly through the COVID quarantine stuff, I've kind of just accepted that this is the way of the world right now. And I'm with my wife and my dog, you know, and I have a nice place to live, have a vehicle. So when I need to, I can go shopping. And, you know, there was a little bit of inconvenience again about it was hard to find paper towels occasionally and things like that. But you know what? I mean, if that's the extent of my problems today, yeah, I got quality problems, you know? Not like I used to. So
no,
that's where I come from. Bailey knows this well. What?
No toilet paper is a big problem.
Now you get Kleenex.
We went through that.
Kleenex instead.
It stuffs the toilet.
Kleenex? No, it doesn't. No,
yes, it does. Ours, anyways. Anyway. Well, you know what?
Well, anyway,
I'm happy.
The point is,
go on.
Go on, Bill.
No, I just finished by saying that the point is that I'm not having a huge reaction. I don't expect to. We are starting to see a relaxation here in Southeast Florida of some of the regulations, and perhaps that'll help. But I'm in no rush to go, you know, dancing in a big crowd or something. You know, I'm going to play it cool because, you know, it's better. I consider that I'm better safe than sorry, and so I'd rather be safe, you know.
Right.
And as I say, I have no huge impetus to get out there amongst the crowds, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to say one thing. I'm alone besides my three boys. I need to be out. I had been going out. I had started socializing more. So for me, I have the need to get out, and especially going to the beach in the evening right before sunset. That's like was one of my ways of that one of my coping mechanisms of dealing with whatever I'm feeling at that moment. So I got to go twice actually in the last week. There are in the evening there are not a lot of people. You can be very distant from, you know, you're not in the crowd. I don't know what it's like during the day. And then, again, last night I finally went out for a drink with a girlfriend. There was no inside seating, only outside seating, and you were distant from every person. You were a few tables away from other people. And I do agree. I will not go into a large crowd. My parents finally came over today. I mean, they had their masks and gloves on. They finally ventured out a little bit after 3-plus months or whatever it is. But they are elderly, but it was nice for them to see their grandchildren. So I have to be careful if I want to be able to see them, not to get sick, God forbid. But, yes, we do this is our new normal for now. And for some people like Bill, it's, you know, he lives every day. He does his thing. It sounds like, Lori, you pretty much the same. For me, it's different. I'm younger. I don't have a partner. And, you know, loneliness and isolation is a struggle for me. So
back to Lori. There was a time where loneliness and isolation was an incredible struggle for me. Mm-hmm. And I had to be with people. I couldn't sit in my house by myself. I didn't know how to do that. So getting quiet with myself is a special treat for me at this point in my life and in my recovery, learning how to sit with myself and not have to be doing something or going somewhere or seeing somebody and having to be busy in order to not be with myself is a wonderful gift. And I truly am grateful for that more than anything else in my life. The only thing I ever felt like I wanted in life was to feel peace. And you can feel peace inside yourself even though there's a lot of turmoil outside. And, you know, I just find that I don't like to be in the midst of the turmoil anymore. I used to gravitate towards that. And I don't like it anymore. It's I'd rather be quiet and be with myself than be in the middle of crowds and going out and being busy. It's probably a result of age as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just water jogging in my pool, you know, before I got on. And things like that are just a gift. And while I was water jogging, I missed my dog because he used to come in the pool with me. and I had to put him to sleep several months ago. And so, you know, there was, it's okay. But did I allow myself to feel sad? Yes. And did it take away from my being in the pool and outside and the sun and feeling the breeze? No, it was just a part of the experience. And that's what I find today, that emotions for me are just part of the experiences that I have day to day in life. Whereas before, I used to get so stuck in one emotion or another that I never thought that I would get through it or get over it. And now it's just a part of the day. If I cry because I miss my dog, it doesn't mean that I'm not feeling good. It just means in that moment, that's coming up for me. So I'm not sure where we're going with all of this. But
well, I would like to say that I haven't found my peace yet. And I either have a lot of turmoil or I'm numb or very empty, feeling very empty. So mm-hmm. I'm still, although I thought I was in a good place, I'm not. A lot of things have come up in the last couple of months that have opened wounds for me. And I'm a survivor of domestic violence. And my children are survivors of abuse because they witnessed it. So just little things that have come up that just open wounds. And those are things that I am working on. And I'm trying to deal with it because it's affecting me trying to have new relationships, trust. I have zero trust. So when you said you're at peace and you have no turmoil, that's my dream. Peace and
not,
health and happiness.
When I say peace, I don't. What I'm saying is that I'm not in a struggle with myself.
Right.
That to me is what peace is. It's not that I don't have feelings when they come up and they come and go, and different things have different effects on me, but I move through it. And I don't move through it as if I'm in a war zone, you know, where I'm fighting with myself and I'm struggling with myself. And I'm so peace for me means lots of different things. But that's one aspect of what I mean when I say peace. It's just allowing myself to be where I am,
right.
Not where I think I should be.
Right. Well, I can't wait to be there.
You're getting there.
Well, you're well on your way. You know, you're really well on your way. You're not that far away. I think all three of us would agree with the notion that we're people of, left to our own devices, so to speak. We're people of extremes, and Bailey just expressed that as saying that she's sometimes in a turmoil, and then she's sometimes completely, I forget the word she used, empty or something.
Empty.
Yeah, we are either, we come from excitement and running around and, you know, like a chicken with its head cut off, or we're deeply depressed. I mean, we're just people of extremes. We swing back and forth between these two, and the trick is to find a middle ground where it's not that life gets perfect. It doesn't. But it gets better to some degree, and the better that it gets is okay for today. That's it. It's okay for right now. That although I have, you know, future hopes and goals and so forth, that's the future. I don't spend my life in the future, and I don't spend it in the past, which is the place of the depression and the wound opening and all that stuff that we talk about. But in the present, the pendulum can stop swinging if I agree that with myself that, you know, maybe things could be better, but they could be a whole lot worse because I've been to both those places. And it's not necessary to go to either one anymore. I can live in a relatively comfortable state if wherever I am today, I'm grateful for or I'm resigned to that it's not as bad as it used to be. And I still have hopes for the future. But just for today, you know, I have to accept today as being as good as it is, and that's okay. And, you know, who knows? The next action, the next day, maybe next week, something's going to change. But right now, it's not a matter of everything getting better, or certainly not perfect. but it is a matter of being engaged in appropriate sort of doing an adequate job at a moderate pace is what it's all about, you know, of life. Doing my job at an adequate job of my life at a moderate pace, because it's the demanding that I get better fast or that I'm a piece of crap from the past. Either one of those, it's gonna you know, backfire on me, and I will have a horrible day one way or the other.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Bill, because you just said something that I thought about. I was talking to some people, working with some people, and one of the things that I find is that people will often say, when this happens, I'll feel better. Or when, you know, it's always something that's going to happen in the future that will make someone feel better or shift. I'll feel better when, instead of how about if I can feel okay now? And it really is interesting when we focus on the here and now and the moment, how we really often are in the past future and we're not in the moment. We're not in what's actually unfolding in our lives today. And I find that is really, that takes work to get there. Because I remember always living in the past or what I thought was happening today, a story that I would come up with in my head about what I thought was occurring today, when in fact, that story was, I've already lived it in my life. And I kept putting the story on today. The same old story would circulate through, you know, and I would impose them on my world as I was living them, or with people that I met, or my mistrust would get triggered. And I'd come up with why I was justified to feel the mistrust that I was feeling and not really ever see what was.
Yeah.
It gets complicated.
I like that. Well, I like that, though. It's almost as if we are determined to find something that will prove us to be either the wonderful, you know, specimen or the piece of crap, you know, one or the other. We search for that stuff, and that's doing ourselves a big disservice, because just for this moment, there are things that I have still left to do today and tomorrow, and there's always going to be stuff. But where I am right now, you're talking on the radio with two of my dear friends, it's not that bad, you know, when I look at it. It's not that bad at all.
No.
Can I chime in and give out our number again? 646-595-2118. Please call in. We have an amazing co-host, Lori Golden, from San Diego, California. 646-595-2118. Go on. I'm sorry, Lori.
No, that's okay. You know, you were talking about not mistrust, Bailey. What were you meaning by feeling mistrust, how that shows up in your life today?
Meeting men, talking to men.
Okay.
Trying to make have friendships. I had a relationship for 2 years after 3 years of being alone. It was a very toxic relationship. And I knew it. I saw the red flags because I was married to somebody for 21 years. I just didn't want to be lonely. And after it finally came to a point where I said to myself, be lonely or cry every day. And I chose be lonely. And it's been 3 months since I've had anything to do with this person, and that's huge. But there's still the pain.
Yeah.
And because again, a lot of things being alone has made me think a lot. And I started realizing it was a very emotionally abusive relationship. And then I start to wonder, I went through that. I knew that. Why did I stay in it? Why did I allow myself to be treated? I'm better than that. I deserve better than that. Was I so desperate? And I have friends that are going through the same kind of thing. And we know the signs of all these kind of abuse and the narcissism and the sociopath and the psychopath, although that kind of abuse and trauma that we've all lived, and we still go back for more. And that's when I realized there were certain pieces that have not healed yet. And there were things that came up through my children that they had found out about and told me that their father had done during my marriage that I did not know about. And that opened up a whole new picture where I said to myself, you know, I buried the man, but I never really dealt with the betrayal, because I found out a lot of the betrayal stuff after we were separated. So I never really healed the betrayal. And I think that, you know, in order to be in a healthy, peaceful, happy place like Bill is, you have to really heal those wounds in order to get to a very healthy, good, happy place and not go back for more from the same, you know, to the same kind of, like, my friends keep attracting the same people. And I'm like, well, that's what I'm attracted to. How do I unattract from that, you know? So that's what I'm, it's, you know, and I'm journaling and, you know, and I have a broken heart and I'm hurt and I'm, you know, I'm not angry at myself. I go through the stages. So I have the empty, numb days and then I have the feeling days. And, you know, you have to deal. You have to bring those coping skills out. You know, I read some of your bio, how, you know, you were a bulimic exerciser. So was I. I have been my entire life. And unfortunately, right before COVID in January, I had a car accident where I was hit, and then a month later, I had another one. So I was starting my recovery, and then I was re-injured. And that took away my running, my kickboxing. For 2 months, I was so depressed. I mean, how many times did I cancel on Bill? I couldn't do the show. I was so dead, because that's my outlet. And I have image issues. It's, you know, it's all all didn't help the matter, you know. And then COVID happened, you know. So it just, I didn't have any outlet. I'm stuck in the house. So I was on lockdown 2 months earlier. So, you know, it's hard. You have children. You have no choice. You have to, I mean, even though they're not babies, you have to get up, do your thing, be a mother. You know, it was very, very hard. And I felt like I was snapping all the time. And even till today, there's something I'm still working on. I feel the days that I'm empty, I feel empty or numb towards everybody, towards even my kids. And then I feel horrible. So anyway, I do relate a lot to, I did not have any childhood abuse, thank God. I have parents, I have a good family. My abuse was, I married an abuser. I feel like I was handpicked. I was very young and naive. I was not a drug user. But I did go through the moments of feeling worthless, you know, alone, desperate, and then you grab on to the only thing you have control over. So that's why there are people that have eating disorders or drug addiction or bulimic. Exercising, I love that term. So you know, whatever you can grab onto that you have control over, because when your life is spiraling and you have no control, and all you have control over is not eating. I'm not eating anything, or I'm going to work out like crazy, or I'm going to eat like crazy, or I'm going to do drugs, or I'm going to drink. You know, so those are the things, like people that have been through childhood abuse and trauma, they grabbed on to the things that they had control over, because obviously you didn't have control over what was happening to you, which is why so many people, I think it's 70% of people in this world that have been through some sort of trauma in their life. Anyway, I'm talking too much.
No, you're not. No, you're not. Actually, I'm really like listening to you, and I appreciate your honesty.
Yeah.
I think that's half the battle, truthfully, is learning how to be honest and open.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's great that you can be honest. I know for me, my exercising started really young in life. I mean, I remember being like 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And
me too.
I was in my bedroom trying to study, but of course I was listening for the sounds of my father lurking somewhere in the house. So I was in tune with listening to him somewhere around me. And I always had to know where he was, what part of the house he was in. I was very hypervigilant. And so I would get, all of a sudden, I'd think, gee, I really want a bite of ice cream. I'd run down, by this point, I was living on the third floor of my home. I would run down two flights of stairs, get some bites, and then run back upstairs. And the running between one bite and another, in between bites, it was the running up and down the stairs, or I would end up doing jumping jacks in my bedroom, because I was so, the food, just doing that warded off some of the fear that I was experiencing. And, you know, when I got into food recovery, it was a long time ago, it was in 1988 or 89, I think it was. And I said I was a food addict, and not only a drug addict, but I was a food addict. And what I was addicted to was sugar. And I realized how I used food to ward off and to numb whatever it was that I was experiencing, especially when I was in fear. And I used to think, you know, I feel so controlled by the I'm fat, I'm thin, the back and forth. I was never heavy. I was never too thin. I was, you know, I was always athletic. I always made sure that I looked a certain way. And, but that actually saved me from having to focus on what I was really feeling. And that was my worthlessness and my deep down shame. See, I thought the shame was because I ate too much on any given day, or I didn't eat enough, or I thought it was about food, just like I thought it was about drugs. And when you peel off these layers of addiction, where what's underneath is all the damage, the real damage, and the real
they call it the
real
the onion. Peeling the onion, the layers
yeah.
of the onion.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, no.
I know a lot about this because my son went through. I realized after my ex was out of the house that my son took a lot of abuse, my oldest, and he was living. He was living in his room in squalor. I didn't know what to do. I mean, he had gone into rehab. I don't know why. He had stolen some of my sleeping pills. I realized he was a bulimic. He was bulimic.
Mm.
And his room was filled with wrappers. And I got him into the best number one facility in South Florida. It's small, it's family owned and run, and they saved his life. Amazing, amazing place. And I learned tons. That's where I really started advocating was for mental health, was because of my son and fighting the insurance companies. But I learned so much information about addictions and abuse, and because people that they would have family nights, and the people that were there were dealing with every kind of issue you can think of. And basically, that's one of the things we learned, is that constantly we have to peel each layer, deal with each layer of pain, damage, trauma to get to the bottom. And I think my son got the best help from all of us, because he dealt with every thing, and he learned the best coping skills. So that's why I understand so much. And then over the last 2 years, I said to myself, did he realize that I always had image issues? Like, did he notice it?
Mm-hmm.
I always wondered if he got it. I mean, it could be genetic, it could be predisposed, but I always wondered if, because you never really think a boy is going to have image issues, you know, but whatever.
My brother did big time.
Yeah. It's horrible. Some of the people there and some of the stories I've heard, and these are kids. We're not talking about adult survivors. We're talking about young that are in so much pain. You know, so much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would cry with them. You know, it really affected me. But the place that he went to was awesome, and I'm always forever indebted because it saved him. So, but anyway, I relate so much, except for the abuse. I do relate to having to tiptoe around my ex-husband. If he was in a mood, you know. All of us did. Me and my kids too.
All right.
Yeah.
Bailey, I just want to notify you that we have Darlene is with us. And if you'd like
do you guys mind
yeah.
if I bring Darlene on? Okay.
course not.
Oh, no. I would love somebody to come on. No.
Hi, Darlene. Welcome.
Yeah.
Darlene.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hi. You're here
Hello.
With Lori, Bill, and I. How you doing?
I'm okay. Thank you.
That's, we're glad
Lori
you called
in. Who's all here?
It's Bill, Lori, and myself, Bailey.
Okay.
Lori's our Golden is our guest from San Diego, California.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. When you said Lori, I should just take it aback. I'm sorry.
Right. We have a lot of people with the same first names, so yeah.
Uh-huh.
This is Lori Golden. Lori Golden, who co-hosts once a month on the what is this? The third Monday, no, Tuesday, I think.
The second Tuesday.
Second Tuesday of each month. She'll be here with us. I have to. We were in the middle of a discussion, darling, and I hope you can catch up in just a second. But one thing that, you know, resonated
okay.
with me about what Bailey just shared was that she expressed that we take on these traits, these habits, these addictions, these actions, because we think we can control, we want control. And, of course, that's obviously it's a misnomer, but they control us. We don't control
yeah.
them. What we're really doing when we get into any of these things is we're trying to avoid who we are and how we feel. And we discover that by drinking a certain amount or doing a certain amount of drugs or running enough with the adrenaline that causes or whatever it is, you know, it can be gambling addiction. It takes you out of how you feel about yourself, and another feeling
mm-hmm.
replaces it. And then it becomes a problem in itself, especially if it's a substance abuse issue that we're talking about, but also if it's a behavior, like food addictions are. But we're really not in control. We may say that we're doing this because we can control the exercising. No, we can't control it. It controls us. And we're simply
right.
avoiding what we feel like without it in our normal, quote with quotes around it, state, you know?
Yeah.
That's
absolutely, Bill.
So, darling,
I think that
we started. Darlene, did you want to say something?
No.
I think we start the behavior because it's the only thing we can control. Yes, obviously, it takes control over us and causes a lot of problems and whatever, but I think when your life is spiraling out of control and you have no control over what's going on with people around you or your feelings, when there's something that you can control, okay, whether it turns out, it's going to turn out obviously into something bad, but like exercise, okay? That's the one thing nobody could take from me. Nobody can stop me from doing it. Or eating, because if somebody has an eating addiction, nobody can stop them from eating. Or drinking or drugs. And then, yes, it does definitely take over us 100%. This is from my experience. So.
Well, I'm saying that I believe that these things are more powerful than us as soon as we start them. So I don't see it as a trying to take control or as something we can control. It's trying to take control, but it's nothing we can control, is what I'm saying.
No,
it's absolutely.
And it's the illusion of control.
Correct.
There really isn't any control. The illusion
right.
of control.
Right.
But Darlene, is there anything you would like to ask or share?
You know, when you said that about exercise, that there ain't nothing that can stop from exercising, I'll beg to differ with that. I have concrete flooring And so whenever I started doing some exercises different times, on my body, because it being so hard when I was doing jumping jacks and different things, I ended up hurting myself really bad because of that. They said, you don't need to exercise on concrete. I'm going, but that's my floor.
Right.
So it stopped me from exercises because it keeps hurting me every time, you know. It's a shock to my body.
To put down. You can buy some mats to put down.
I bought a mat and was doing it even on a mat, but the concrete underneath it was still too. I didn't get one of them real thick ones. I bought just a regular one that I could lay on and I could do sit-ups and stuff. But when I tried to do jumping jacks, it still was not thick enough, if you know what I'm saying, to reduce the shock for my knees and everything from the concrete.
Right.
And I'm like, I hate that because it started, you know, I like to exercise. I like to line dance. I like, you know, and then it stops me, you know.
Did you notice
anything?
I like
a couple of drinks. And then I like a couple of more. And then why not have a couple more after that? I mean, that's how this stuff is. It becomes excessive in itself. And it's almost immediately, it's stronger than us. Okay, let's put it that way. As Lori said, it's an illusion that we're going to control it. It controls us.
Right.
And all we're doing is avoiding the original feelings that we had before we decided to take it up. When I drank,
yep.
I got a certain ease and comfort that I relished. That was the peace that Lori said she was seeking all her life. Me too. I wanted peace. And alcohol, you know, provided that for a while. But it didn't take very long before I was drinking not just a couple of beers, but a couple of pitchers of beer, you know, or whatever. And this is true with
right.
all these things. And then they are, and so it's right from the beginning. It's an illusion that we're in control at all. We're not in control of anything, frankly, anything.
Right.
Except maybe the next decision on the next action every moment. That's about it. And not even the results of that action are we in control of, only the action itself. My job is to consider the situation I'm in, what's the next appropriate thing for me to do, which I think is the best choice of the various choices I have. I take that under consideration, and I decide to take an action based on it, and I do it, but I don't know what the result's going to be. I hope that there's, you know, a better outcome than, you know, because it's hard for me to even imagine anything in the middle. Again, we're people of extremes. We tend to imagine the worst that can happen to me and the best that can happen to me, like hitting the lotto, you know, or being on the street in the gutter. That's the two extremes. And, you know, living a middle-class life in an okay neighborhood with a car that, yeah, it needs a little repair, but it still runs. God forbid, that's my world, but that is my world. And it's okay today, you know. But if something is wrong with that scenario, if the car needs repair, then I have to decide, am I going to go get the car repaired? And if I'm not, I have to be willing that it's going to break down even further. But if I am, then I have to, I have to get the fix done and hope that I pick the right mechanic, kind of, you know, because he's in control, not me. All I can make control about is the decision, you know.
Yep.
Most of the time, though, if I can take rational opportunities to progress with actions that are sort of towards the solution and away from the problem, neither the best case scenario I can imagine will happen, nor, of course, the worst. Something in the middle happens, and that's okay. You know, that's okay. So.
Well, I'm going to welcome my friend Leah and bring her on. I'm not sure if she heard the rest of the beginning of the show.
Great.
Hi,
Leah. We have our guest, Lori Golden, is from San Diego, California. We have Darlene here, Bill, and I. I don't know if you listened before?
I didn't. Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get to get on earlier. I apologize.
It's okay. Lori, do you want to fill her in about what we were talking about and continue more?
Oh, you don't have
Lori?
To.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, a range of things. But we were just talking about addiction overall, whether it's food addiction, it could be any kind of addiction, and our desire to try to, I know for me, when I got, I'm a recovering drug addict for 33 years now, and I know for me, when I found drugs, I felt the illusion, it was this belief that no one could get me. And really what I was saying is it was a way for me to protect myself by not feeling what I was feeling. But the belief me was no one could get me. And I remember
no one could get you because you were on drugs, you're saying? You were protected?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was protected.
That's the feeling. Wow.
And I remember the very first time I went from college back to visit my home where my father was my abuser and I grew up with incest. And I had an amphetamine in my back pocket. And it was the first time I felt safe just by having that amphetamine in the back of my pocket. Because
wow.
I knew it could relieve me of whatever it was I was going to feel. Now, I didn't understand this at the time, but I remember so clearly feeling like I was a Hulk, you know, because I had an amphetamine in my back pocket. And
wow.
I feel like we use things to think we're protecting ourselves from, and protection for me was not feeling as awful as I felt.
Right.
Always seizing what I was experiencing in the moment. So if I was afraid, it would lessen my fear. If I was tired, it could wake me up. If I felt dumb, it could make me smart. You know, if I did a certain kind of drug, if I couldn't sleep, then a drug would put me to sleep. So I felt the illusion of being in control of things, when in reality, I wasn't in control of anything. All I was doing was keeping the pain inside me at a comfortable distance so I could function in the world. And it, of course, the closer I got to feeling something, the more drugs, the more things I would need to not feel. And that's become the cycle. You know, we start using more and more. It's never enough. There's never relief at the end of the tunnel. There's this constant feeling of trying to keep something from yourself. You don't know what that is. You just know it makes all the pain go away. What I felt with when I first discovered drugs, I felt like the answer to all my problems. Little did I know my problems were just beginning.
Wow.
It's what happens when we take a substance or an activity to its extreme is we never feel. We're constantly covering up the feelings. And, of course, the feelings are the issue. That's what we have to learn how to deal with. And until we come to a place of cleanliness or recovery or sobriety or whatever the problem is, we never give ourselves a chance to feel. So we have no tools other than the substance. And so when we emerge from that, we're at a complete loss. It's a very dangerous place for us to be. We can be extremely destructive, but thank God there are, in my case, 12-step programs, and Lori's too, I think, that envelops us, that put their arms around us, and they knew that we didn't know. They knew how we felt. We felt raw. You know, we didn't know what to feel. And it took a while for our feelings to even be controllable to the degree where we could even name them. And we were probably wrong the first few times we tried to name them. But, you know, the point is that we never allow ourselves to feel, so we never allow ourselves to even begin the process of any kind of maturity or healing or growth.
Yep. That's very true.
So we got into this conversation. I was fascinated with the term Laura used, that she went through. She used it, she used the word bulimic exercising. Sound familiar?
Do you know about that, Leah?
Well,
she knows
no,
about
not me.
She knows about
it's about Bailey.
She knows about
right. I
she
just
knows
didn't
about
know Bailey was going to admit that, right?
No, I know
gotcha.
That my exercise because when you have image issues, which I've had my entire life, I don't think it'll ever go away. I
also
did learn
anorexia nervosa, I believe, right?
No.
Yeah.
Because this is
wait.
Exercising, like when you over-exercise.
No,
that
includes, I think it's under the same umbrella.
Yeah, it is.
But I could be
it
wrong. Right, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
But, which I did have at one point, but I don't have anymore. And, but the image is, I used to associate skinny and happy. And that I learned with a lot of therapy is a no-no. But the exercising that when I was saying it's the one thing I have control over. That's the one thing I still I call it my outlet. So I mean, unfortunately, I can't do as much as I did before because I'm still recovering. But all my girlfriends and Leah and I are in our 40s. We know each other since we're 15. They know me since then as the exerciser. And Leah is actually a trainer. So she knows, you know, exercise, nutrition, all that stuff. But, yeah, okay. Somebody else want to pipe in?
Is there anybody that would... Yeah, good.
Okay, you know, just like Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and we're just merely the players, basically, you know. That's the way I felt, and I would laugh about it after I learned that in school. Years later, you know, that kept playing on my mind. It's like I was just playing like almost like in a video of just living and just existing, basically. And it's like I wasn't really delving into any feelings or anything. And it's like the first time when I went to one of the good therapists, and she was like, how are you doing today? I didn't know what emotion I was feeling. She had to end up giving me an emotion wheel, and you know, and you turn that wheel, and it was tough trying to figure out what emotion I was feeling, you know. I said, I'm feeling this, but I'm also feeling that, but so what is the right word? And this is, none of these are the right words right here, so I don't know, you know. Like Bill was saying, you know, it's so hard to pin down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you said a mouthful there when you started, with Shakespeare's quote from Shakespeare. We're not only the actors on a stage, but I believe that we are also the director, the set builder, the painter. We cast the other characters. We do it all, and we have to do it all. We have to be, this is our fantasy control. My narcissistic childhood image of myself was that I was in a movie literally, of a life, and that all the characters that were also in the movie were only needed when they walked into the room or the space that I was in. Then they would animate and do whatever their job was to do, and when they walked out of that room, they froze. They disappeared. That's how my kid's brain saw life for a while, and I still identify with that today. If I'm not careful, I am a person who relishes the fantasy of control, and I don't just want to be the actor. I want to be the producer, the director, the set builder, I want to do it all and have everybody behave. Everybody behave. And that's not realistic, but I think it's very common for us. It's completely egocentric, of course. Completely.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but we as we have, we don't know how to act. I mean, I'm not saying as far as behaving or misbehaving. I'm talking about, we don't see the middle ground. We see what could happen if we do this. But we don't know whether it's going to turn out good or bad, but we just don't see a middle ground there. So you were right about that.
Right.
Is there any topic or any question that anyone would like to bring up right now?
Well, that I if I could, is it okay for me to go back to the question about addiction?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Oh,
okay.
Sure.
Does addiction control someone so much to the degree where you would go as far as to say that they have no, how do I word this? Where even the ones closest to them that they absolutely love, they will do anything for that to get the fix. If that means keeping away from your loved ones because you have to be secretive about it, and you also, in order to get it, in order to use it, in order to all of that, like, would you
yeah.
say that it controls them to the degree where they almost aren't, I don't know if it's incapable of love, but at that point you're kind of cutting yourself off from all love. Yeah, from all the connection of the closest people to you.
Absolutely.
Heck yeah. I'd say it's at least that. I mean, Lori shared a story, I don't know if you were here for it, about having
a pill in
her back pocket. She had a pill in her back pocket, and so she knew when she went home she'd be okay because she had the pill in her back pocket, right? I did the same thing.
Yeah.
With me, it was hash and pot most of the time, which I took home. I was allowed to drink at home, but it wasn't enough. I then had to leave the house, with a joint or two, and go for a walk in the neighborhood and get stoned and then come back. That was,
I guess, what I'm,
you
trying,
know what?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I sacrificed my ability to have a true relationship with my family when I did that. Of course. The drugs are
That's
more
what
important.
I'm saying. The drugs are more important. They give up all contact. So that's my question. I'm, I have this situation with an individual, and I think I have internalized in my mind, I'm not fully excusing the addict. So in my mind, I'm thinking it's more psychopathic behavior, so beyond inflicting pain and so selfish that I see it more as that, as I say, whatever you want to call psychopathic, whether it's a handicap, a mental illness, I don't know. I look at it as that, but I guess I don't know enough about addiction. That's
well,
my
so
question.
We say you're dealing with a person who is sick.
Yeah, I'm dealing with a person who's sick. Yes.
That's
so
an illness,
sick.
No matter what diagnosis it is. It's an illness. It's not a moral issue. They no longer can control that part of them.
They no longer have morals. Right, right. No morals.
Right. But you're not.
So you're saying
with
it completely consumes them, where they could almost look like they don't care at all, like it's, they're psychopathic, but really that's not the case? Is that
what
you're saying?
I'll let Lori answer that, but I would say quickly yes, but Lori's our psychologist here.
Well, it doesn't, it's not so much that I'm coming from a place of being actually built a psycho. I mean, I'm a social worker, a licensed clinical social worker, but
okay.
I will say, right, psychotherapist.
Jeez.
I know, when people say, I'm telling you, I have to deal with this all the time. Anyway, when people say, when I was consumed with using drugs, I was consumed with self-hatred.
Mm-hmm.
The drugs just made me, I didn't have to see my self-hatred, but I was
mm-hmm.
consumed with self-hatred. So how could I possibly be caring and loving to another person when all
mm-hmm.
I wanted to do was hurt myself? You know, drugs, it's a self-destructive experience. It's not like you're thinking, oh, I'm out to hurt somebody. You're out to thinking, I hate myself. I mean, I used to
right.
feel like I hated myself. And,
right.
you know, at one time I tried to commit suicide on my drugs. And,
wow.
you know, the bottom line is I didn't have, I didn't have a clue how to love me and how to be good to me. How could I possibly know how to be good to somebody else? Or be considerate of somebody else. Because when you're singing and you get in the grip of it, and it does grip you, it's like an imprisonment. You're imprisoned in it. And, you know, all you know is the pain that you're in. You can't see that you're causing and inflicting pain in other people. You can't see it. You're too focused on your own pain and getting rid of your pain. And you're too focused on being self-destructive and wanting more. And the more you get, the more you want. And the cycle is just a vicious, self-loathing, self-destructive cycle. It's not about being a psychopath. It's about not having any self-love whatsoever, not knowing how to care about oneself. All I knew was how to hurt myself. And the more I was hurting myself, the more in control I felt, in some insane illusion.
So I see, I misinterpreted the fact that the person who has no compassion and lacks empathy towards people, and including myself, those closest to them. And I can, in my mind, that's because that's the same traits as psychopaths, but you're saying that's, an addict is capable of the same thing.
I'm not a psychopath, and I doubt
no, I know that.
No,
so, I know that. Well,
I'm
that's what
saying.
I'm saying. That's where how
right.
I misunderstood,
what?
Because they lack empathy. And that's the
but
same traits you're saying. You couldn't feel for anyone else.
I couldn't
it's not
feel
that
it
they,
for
it's not so much they lack empathy as their focus is completely on themselves. And I'll talk about me. My focus, like Lori said, was on me. I hated Bill. I hated what Bill had brought into his adulthood. And when I found alcohol, it was soothing. And pretty soon it became a problem because I drank alcoholically from the beginning. And then I discovered
okay.
drugs. So from then on, I just simply became a chemist. And I've been asked before, what's your drug of choice? My drug of choice was, what do you got? You know, I took it all. I did everything except shoot intravenously. That I didn't do. But I smoked heroin. You know, I snorted it. I did coke, I did acid, I did mescaline, which I liked a lot. I did tons of pot and hash. I did all kinds of pills. I did poppers. I did everything.
Wow.
And really,
so said,
I mean,
right,
if
you
I
said
knew
meth,
you, if
meth
I,
was your favorite, you said? Is that
mescaline,
what you said?
Mescaline.
Mescaline.
But I rarely could get my hands on it, but I loved that drug. Anyway, the point is that it was never enough. And so if I knew you had anything on you, I was going to be your friend until we shared it. For sure.
Bingo, Bailey. You heard that?
Yes, but I want to just, I know what Leah is getting at with the psychopathy. A person that's a drug addict can also have, well, they do have mental illness, but they can also have personality, narcissistic, psychopath, sociopath added on to that. And she's referring to a person, she's referring to a person that has all of that, that it's making sense that they got in, of how they got into drugs was because they hated themselves. And because of abuse and whatever. And then it's gotten so out of control to the point where forget all the other mental issues. She's understanding more now why they're in the situation they're in, because what you guys are saying about the drug, that you hate yourself, which is one of the things we already knew about this person, is that they did not like themselves, and drinking and drugs has become their life to a point where they're now dealing, and
it's dealing just to get by, just to get the fix and have enough money to live on. It's not even like with the, at least it doesn't appear to be with big aspirations. It's really like you're saying, day to day, his entire life is just consumed by that. But I guess in order to make a living, it made most sense if you love drugs to actually do it for a profession.
You know,
you can get
there's
it.
Something you need to understand. You said love drugs. I didn't love drugs. I loved that I didn't have to feel me.
Feel,
right.
That's
right.
What I
right.
love.
It's
not
addiction. It's the addiction.
Right.
It's
the ability not to feel.
Feel.
I mean, it's the ability to, when I came off drugs, was the first time I started having flashbacks and memories of being incested by my father. Up until 37 years old, I had absolutely no memory of incest. So no wonder when I found drugs in my late teens, that was like a solution beyond solutions. It was like, wow, this is it. It felt like I was gripped immediately in the ecstasy of not feeling, of being away from myself. And believe me, it's very powerful. You know, people use drugs, addictions for all sorts of reasons, but it's really to stay away from ourselves. That's really
right.
What the goal of it is. And if you're trying to stay away from yourself, then you can never feel good about yourself. You don't even know who you are. I didn't even know who I was. How could I mean, I might have looked self-centered, but I was in excruciating pain constantly, but numbing myself to my pain.
Right.
But knowing if I didn't get the drug, I wouldn't survive because I wouldn't be able
anything?
To tolerate.
Would you have done anything to get that drug? Yeah.
I would visit friends and go in their bathrooms, lock the door, and steal their pills. I would take, would I do anything? I never got to the point where I was desperate. I had money. I had work. But would I do anything? I could see getting that desperate, yes.
Okay.
At the end, I was very good. Yeah, at the end, I was very desperate. I can't
so
say.
So you were betraying your friends?
Yeah, of course. I was betraying myself. I wasn't a good
right.
friend to me. How could I possibly know what it meant to be a good
right.
friend to my friends?
Right.
It's not. And
you would change.
Me.
You would switch in like a love. You would give up the love for the drug.
Because the drug was the only thing that was keeping me far enough from myself.
Right.
Because I didn't know what was underneath.
Wow.
I had no memory of incest whatsoever until I came off drugs. That's saying a lot.
Wow. Yeah, it does say a lot.
And believe me,
I remembered everything perfectly well, and I wished I didn't.
Right.
So my drinking, when I started it, was to drink to oblivion. I mean, I was a really sloppy, early drunk. I threw up and passed out, and, you know, I crashed cars. I never killed anybody, never hurt anybody, but I destroyed several cars, and I walked away from everything. And then I discovered that the drugs, I didn't have to drink as much. I still always drank. But I added, you know, other substances that, as Lori's saying, it got me out of Bill, and it took more and more of this stuff. Then I started hanging out with lower companions who supplied me with this because I agreed to be part of that social circle, which was way below me, frankly, where
right.
I came from. But it was perfect for me because there were always pounds of drugs. It was a bar that we all worked at. I worked there 3 different times and left 3 different times. But I always came back. I played in a band that I wasn't that attracted to because the owner of the bar was in the band, and he always had drugs, and he would get me stoned all the time. And of course, we were in a bar, so we had alcohol was legal. We had it all around us all the time. I lived 1 block from my house. I mean, from my work. This was in Brooklyn Heights. I only had to cross 1 street to get home, and thank God I never had to drive. And, you know, the cops all knew, but we were not troublesome type people. And they knew who the dealer was, the local dealer. We'd buy our marijuana, for example, by the pound from this guy. And they all knew who he
right.
was. And then we'd split up the pound between 3 of us.
Interesting,
you know,
why they never stopped that.
They didn't because we weren't troublemakers. We were part of the community.
No, I'm talking
very
about the dealer.
So.
I'm talking about the dealer.
Yeah, no. Well, so was he. But I'm saying, so was he. He was not a troublemaker. So it was
right.
all understated and in control in the sense that they knew that it was going on and we were not criminal. Now, at the end of my stint in Montecito Heights, I mean in Brooklyn Heights, coke started to come into the scene, and that scared me because when I left, I knew I was going to get addicted to coke if I was around it. And where did I end up? I plopped down in Santa Monica on my pursuit of my career and lived in a house where a guy was selling coke. It was horrible. And I was scraping,
wow.
I was sneaking in his room and trying to find his stash. And, you know, he would throw me lines of coke because someone was there and he was selling them a quantity, you know, and it was horrible. And I did instantly get addicted to coke. So I had to
right,
leave
it's highly
fast.
Addictive, right?
Oh, it's horrible. And I had to leave there fast or else I wouldn't have escaped. And so I only stayed with this guy maybe 3 weeks, maybe two, but just a short period of time. One day he said, you know, I told him, I'll live with you, but I'm not going to sell anything because that's what he did for a living. He said, well, no, I won't make you sell anything. And one day he says, there's a guy coming over and you just have to give him this envelope and he'll give you an envelope. I said, I'm not doing that. And the guy said, no, it's not drugs. It's just, you know, envelopes.
Right.
The guy and my friend went out of the house, and the guy came over, sure enough, knocked on the door, then banged on the door, then pounded on the door. Then he went out in front of the apartment yelling up at it, you know, I know you're in there, and
exactly.
caused such a ruckus, the cops got called, and they took him away. And I left that night because I told Mike, this guy, I was not going to do it, and I didn't. But, you know, I came that close to selling cocaine. Yeah, you're capable. You are capable of breaking,
yeah.
of crossing a moral line that you or an ethical line that you never thought you'd cross. Absolutely, it's within the realm of capability.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah, it is. It is in the realm of capability for anyone who gets heavily involved in drugs or alcohol. Yeah. Or any addiction.
Wow. Wow. So that's just thank you all, because that just gave me a clearer understanding.
Yeah.
There's no way to help somebody who doesn't want to get help. They have to hit rock bottom, right?
Yep.
Yes, and they have to and they have to do it themselves. Nobody can do it for you in terms of, you know, getting clean and sober. And
there's
it's
no
hard.
Such thing, even with an intervention specialist, which I've read on some of the NA websites.
An intervention specialist, just like a recovery program, none of that is a guarantee that someone will stay clean and sober.
Yeah.
Well, chances are not if they're doing this for a living now. So there's no way they're getting help.
What
they're
is
gonna
that
have to
noise?
Hit rock bottom. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me mute it.
Is that you? No, I was just curious what that was. It sounded like some kind of...
It's a siren.
Yeah.
I'm outside because it's nice outside and my apartment's too hot.
Oh,
my AC's not working.
That's interesting. It's a siren. It doesn't sound like a siren.
It is. It's like it's like the firehouse.
It sounds like a boat. Oh, it sounds like a boat. Like you. It just
like
reminded
lighthouse.
Me of being out. Yeah, like being out on the water. That's what I thought about when I heard it.
Sorry, I can
either that or
oh, no,
Jericho on his horn.
That's okay. I don't mind the sound. It was more like I was trying to place that sound. That's
yeah.
where my head went.
Bailey, you've
but
led a terrific show. Lori, you've done a terrific job. We're right at the end. I just don't want Bailey to miss it. But there's only a couple minutes left.
Okay. And is there anything in particular that we can say wrapping this up?
Bailey, that's you. You're the host.
You're the host, Bailey.
I don't know what happened to her.
Okay, so I'll wrap it up. We only have, okay. According to the clock here.
Oh, she's here. She's
okay,
here.
I'm here.
We got...
Hello.
We're coming up on 90
Hello,
seconds,
I'm,
Bailey.
I'm here.
Okay, we got it.
Nobody hears me?
Show.
Yeah, we hear you. We're 90 seconds till the show ends.
I'm here. You don't hear me? Hello?
Oh, you don't hear us.
She's not hearing
you.
Us.
Are you?
Yeah,
you
I
hear us?
Okay, you got 60.
Yeah.
We're 60 seconds till the end of the show, Bailey, so we got to wrap it up.
Okay, so do you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So
yes.
Let Lori close us out, and I mean, say the last whatever, and then Bill, if you want to close us out.
Okay, Lori.
Yeah.
60 seconds.
I know. I don't need to talk. I just really want to say that I appreciate people sharing with me and letting me be a part of your night. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate
thank you
being here.
Yeah,
with us.
It was great.
It was a great show.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. All right. This is Bill for Bailey saying God bless you and the children of the world, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse. Thank you, Lori, one more time.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was gone. You are forgotten after all that you've done. Another
Radio.